Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode number 3. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading over to the east of England, to Lincolnshire and the very heart of British farming country, to speak to Andrew Ward, MBE. Andrew, how are you?
Hello, Will. Good evening. Yes, you're quite right. We are in eastern England, but you've gotten one very important part in the introduction. Lincolnshire is known as the breadbasket of the world.
Okay. It's the largest producer of wheat in the country, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Produces lots of things besides wheat and barley, lots of vegetables. I can't remember whether it's something like 60% of the UK's vegetables are grown in Lincolnshire, I think.
So I believe I did do a little bit of research. I think I wrote down largest producer of wheat, cereals, potatoes, poultry, and the second largest producer of sugar beet. And 38% of the bulbs grown in Britain are grown in Lincolnshire too. So, yeah, it's proper farming country where you are.
Very, very important county. Yes, it is, exactly. Yes, it is. But very diverse range of soils. We've got grade one silts all around Boston that, two crops a year, and very, very expensive soils. And then going to grade two and then grade three soils where we are with the sort of heavy clays and things. So very diverse range of soil types.
Yeah, okay. And you were telling me just before we started recording, you haven't been on the farm the last week or two. You've been stuck on jury duty in Lincoln.
I have, yeah. I spend a lot of time away from the farm anyway with the various committees I'm on and various things I chair and conferences I speak at. The last 2 weeks, this is the second week, I'm actually, doing jury service in Lincoln Crown Court. Yeah. And not the best of things to do. Stunning location. In the grounds of Lincoln Castle, I've just got on another case and it will run till the middle of next week, I've been told. So we'll see how that runs. So yes, meeting all sorts of people, and nobody else in the rest of the jury are farmers.
Okay. You've managed to avoid getting sent down for contempt of court so far then?
At the moment, but I can tell you what, Will, it's very early days yet.
Can you tell us a bit about your farming operation there, Andrew? You're obviously farming in a big way, but can you tell some of the listeners about
that? Well, yeah, we are in some ways, but we're not in others. When you look at some of the organisations and companies in Lincolnshire, we're farming around 660 hectares in total. Okay. And that's a mixture of a couple of smaller contract farms. It's some tenanted land that I've got on an Agricultural Holdings Act tenancy. So I'm the second generation of that. And for those people who don't know, there's three generations run on those tenancies.
Yes.
And they are been going quite a few years. And the rent per acre is a lot less than, say, if you're on a farm business tenancy. Yes. They're one of the newer ones. So the cropping we grow oilseed rape, and that is a special kind of rape that when the rape is crushed, the oil goes to McDonald's. So and with regard to that, we are at McDonald's flagship farm, of which there are 23 in Europe, and I think there's a couple in the UK that provide beef to McDonald's, and maybe one in Ireland, but we're the one that provides oil. And there are a few other farmers growing the same crop as well, but it's a very healthy oil.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So do they come out and have you got quite a close working relationship with McDonald's? Do they come out?
We have had in the past. It's in sort of Spurges and Lulls. And obviously to do a McDonald's flagship farm or to be part of their program, you have to pass lots of tests, lots of environmental tests. You have to be, obviously, do lots of different things to help protect the environment, protect nature. And so they have been over and they're sort of, you know, monitoring that, if you like, to see whether we've continually fit the criteria.
I'm very proud
to have that, because there's only 23 farms in the whole of Europe that have got a flagship farm status, and for us to have that is quite a prestigious sort of title, I suppose.
That's right, and they're big supporters of British farming, aren't they, McDonald's?
So. They are, and, it's not a common, commonly known thought that a lot of people think McDonald's don't serve very good food and they're not as supportive, but they are.
They
serve very, very wholesome food. They have very high standards on where they buy their beef and their chicken and their bread from, and obviously their oil. And everything that now is in a McDonald's restaurant is to a very high standard.
That's right. So you're a family business as well?
Yes, we are. We're a family business. My father started the farm in 1958. Started at the other side of Lincoln, about 17 miles away from where I am now. And then there was very few opportunities there. So we then came over to Ledenham, to the village where we are, and sort of tenanted, rented some land, and then bought a small farm nearby, and we've gradually expanded over the years.
Okay. So
besides oilseed rape, we are also growing winter and spring wheat. We're growing, just taken on a contract with the company KWS, growing spring wheat for seed. We're growing spring malting barley, and that goes to Coors Brewery.
Burton-on-Trent
to make Grolsch Lager and Carling Lager. And sugar beet as well is a very important crop for us, and that goes to the local factory at Newark, which is only 11 miles away.
So you've got, you said you've got a variety of soil types there, and you're a big no-till man. I know, you know, I follow you on Twitter, and you're obviously a big a pioneer of that, really. So can you tell us a bit more about
We're no-till and low-till, and you know, we have very, very heavy clay soils here, and we are looking at different ways of farming and different ways of establishing crops.
Yeah.
And we've been sort of doing things differently to a lot of UK farmers for a few years now. A lot of that has been driven by our knowledge of costs. I know to the penny what all our machines cost to operate. I know to the penny what our costs are and cost per ton of production. And obviously, when you know those and you see some of the figures, you get quite alarmed when you see how high they are.
Yeah.
So we do things very differently. You know, the heavy soils, we do still cultivate a lot of those, but we only cultivate them once, whereas a lot of farmers will go in fields with machines probably 6 or 7 times. So we do things a little differently, but we are an agri iFarm, and Agri is the distributor company who have agronomists as well, and sort of give advice to farmers. And and Agri have well over 20 of their what they call iFarms, and they're like information stroke demonstration farms dotted around the country. And we are the one for Lincolnshire.
Okay.
And we do lots of trials and have open days where different farmers come to us. So we work very closely with a number of big companies.
Okay. So one of those is Simba Great Plains, isn't it? I know you host farmers and agronomists from the UK and abroad and on your farm. And
We've done that actually for a few years, and I do get a huge amount of satisfaction, and I do get a lot. I really enjoy it because I feel we're at the forefront of sort of the European farming job, and being able to associate and have discussion and actually try out other practices, if you like, and pass on knowledge to other farmers. And I'm not one of these people that keeps everything to myself. I think we're all in the same job together.
Yeah.
You know, we need to sort of communicate, and we need to mix and match and help each other. And so I do have regular sessions. I go abroad to other countries like Poland and Czech Republic and Hungary and places like that, and France with Simba Great Plains, and have been doing this for about 10 years now, and you know, having these other companies come to the farm, and basically I enjoy them telling us what they think we're doing wrong, which is great.
And they, I mean, you're obviously a people person. You must enjoy you know, as farmers, we can all get a bit isolated and a bit stuck on the tractor, but you obviously enjoy that side of it, working with people and
I do. Yes, you've actually hit it on the head, Will. Yeah. I do enjoy interacting with other people and surrounding myself, I suppose, with like-minded people, because I think, you know, it's well known that if you're a positive type of person yourself, which I'd like to think I am, if you surround yourself with positive people, you know, you keep going up and you keep going in the right direction. Where if you surround yourself with negative people and people who are not sort of forward thinking, you know, they drag you down to your level, or rather to their level. They'll drag you down to their level, which is not where I want to be in some cases.
Absolutely. See, you also work with, I told you on Twitter when I was researching you, I felt like some sort of creepy stalker, but you know, it's kind of a hazard of this job, but you work with Simba, with Howsam sprayers, with AgriEye, GrowHow, Wold Marsh, HGCA Bayer, and many others. I mean, as you've said, I mean, you know, I'm sure you could just focus on 100% on running and growing your own business, but you're obviously very passionate about the future of the arable and indeed the farming industry by involving yourself with so many partnerships.
I am, and I think it's something that we all should be doing. Mm. We all have to live, and to live we have to eat food, and enable us to produce food, we need to do it in a sort of healthy, sustainable way, with the help of lots of organisations. And to me, it's far easier for us to have an association and help each other, rather than the farmer to be on one side of the fence and the supplier or manufacturer on the other side of the fence, and never actually sit on the fence and talk to each other.
Yeah.
And I really, really strongly feel that is a major, major flaw. And I know there's so many farmers in the country that say, oh, I can't tell them that, I'm not telling them that. And I just can't believe some people have this sort of attitude. And for me, if I didn't have the association I do with all these companies and do the trials that we do with the companies, I really do not know how we would operate and how we'd farm going forward, because I think it is a major sort of a thing for us is to sort of look forward and have associations with these companies and work with them and always be at the forefront of technology, because you know what it's like, Will. Farming is changing at an alarming pace.
And
keeping up with it is I wouldn't say it's difficult, but keeping up with it is a challenge.
Yeah.
And if you do it on your own, I think it even becomes more of a challenge.
That's right. Well, speaking of challenges, then I was going to ask you about this a bit later. But speaking of challenges facing the arable industry and farming in general, with Brexit going on at the moment, is that something that, I'm not going to ask you which way you're voting on it, because we're all sick of discussing that, I think, but like it or not, it's happening. As someone who's high profile within the industry and speaks to all these organisations representing us, are you confident that the government will support us as an industry going forward?
Oh, dear, Will.
That's a broad question,
not,
I know.
Not really, because I've always had the view that I think sometimes we're on our own. Yes, we do have some governments, and some years we get supported more than other. But I do really believe that British agriculture and the countryside is not understood by the government. And I don't care whether it's Labour or Conservative. We have had good times under both governments, and we've had bad times under both governments. And I really, really strongly believe that they do not understand how the countryside works, what makes the countryside tick, and I think they don't understand food production and the things we have to put up with. And I don't know when they will. Probably, hopefully, Brexit might start a process, but I would like to see more MPs, more people get out onto farms and actually see the issues we have to deal with and how we try and produce food. Because until they do, I don't think that the government fully understands what we're doing and what the countryside's about.
No. Well, yeah, I have the same worry, I'm afraid, really. But so on this similar theme, then, one of the main reasons I wanted to speak to you tonight was about glyphosate. Glyphosate's in the news recently. Its license is going to be is up for review at the end of this year with the European Commission. First of all, for people who might not know, you hear these sort of terms thrown around, Roundup, glyphosate. People who might not know, what is it? What is it?
Well, it is the most widely used chemical in the world. It's for sale in garden centres. Big shops sell it. So it's not just farmers and professional growers that use it. No. Your everyday person on the street can buy it in a garden centre and can use it the same as we do. Yet mm-hmm. we all have to have training, and it's all applied through high-tech machines, as you know.
Yeah.
Yet members of the public can buy it out of a sort of a squeezy bottle with a spray vaporizer and use it on the garden paths and in the garden. Now, obviously, the active ingredient of Roundup is glyphosate, as you say, and that is the active ingredient of it. The products that we buy are a lot stronger than what you can buy in a garden centre. But the common perception is that Roundup is Monsanto, which, yes, the brand name is Monsanto. However, now there are over a dozen companies around the world that are making glyphosate.
Yep.
And so you'll see on social media and you'll see in the press that they're saying glyphosate and Roundup is bad. And nearly in the same sentence, you always see GMOs mentioned and, you know, genetically modified crops. And they all think that if we get rid of glyphosate, genetically modified crops will go, which will also get rid of Monsanto.
Yeah.
Without realizing that Monsanto now are not the only ones producing glyphosate.
That's right.
So it all seems to be linked in a way to GMOs and Monsanto. However, on the sort of plus side, glyphosate, as well as being the most widely used chemical in the world, it is also the safest chemical in the world. And the common perception at the minute, and the reason why some organisations and green parties are trying to get it banned, is they're saying it's carcinogenic and it causes cancer. Well, that is not the case. The report has just come out lately for the European Chemicals Agency that it is not carcinogenic. And for actual anybody to get to the maximum residue limit, or the MRL, which is a safety standard limit, it's not the limit that sort of does you harm, a human needs to eat 2.5 times their body weight in bread a day. Well, of course, that is just not realistic.
No.
You know, and this is the problem we've got. We've got the safest chemical in the world is trying to be banned by some people because they're saying it causes cancer. And it's the old hazard and risk situation. You know, then they're saying it's probably carcinogenic, and so they want it banned. Well, you know, I say to them, Will, that if you cross the M1 motorway in rush hour, you would probably get run over.
That's right.
But are they going to ban it? Are they going to ban the car?
Yeah. I read the potential carcinogenic risks are lower than coffee and bacon, aren't they? And
they are, and they're lower than salt.
That's
right. And they're lower than alcohol.
That's right.
And it's the same with anything. So, you know, when you see somebody drinking a coffee, they're actually drinking something that is more toxic than glyphosate.
That's right.
And it's all in the dose. And there's a really good adage, and a good friend of mine, Sean Sparling, has put on Twitter and in lots of articles that the most dangerous thing about glyphosate is the van that delivers it.
Yeah.
And that is more likely
that's
to do your harm and kill you than the product inside.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And yeah, and if any of you haven't seen the Sean Sparling's petition, I'm sure there's a link to it on his Twitter page, but check
there
it
is.
Out. At SAS Agronomy, isn't it, his Twitter handle?
That's right. That's his Twitter name. That's right. But
that's
right. So it is a very interesting story. But the thing is that the organisations are trying to get it banned. They're saying that a lot of late harvest or late summer treatments are getting glyphosate into the bread because some farmers in the north of England actually treat the crops very late on and actually sort of kill the crop with it to help it ripen quicker.
Yeah.
And it reduces their harvest costs and it reduces the greenhouse emissions and all those things when you're growing crops north, you know, further north you go. So there's huge benefits to glyphosate. We here in Eastern England, we very rarely use it pre-harvest apart from oilseed rape. We do put it on oilseed rape to help the speed up the harvest process. But our main job is pre-drilling or pre-sowing of the next crop to kill off a weed we have called blackgrass that is resistant to all herbicides apart from glyphosate. And for us, that really is a huge, huge area that we use it. It's very environmentally friendly. It allows us to produce food cheaper. It allows us to protect the environment, protect bird nests, and protect ground nesting birds, and also save the soil biology. And it helps us because if you didn't have glyphosate, you would have to try and control blackgrass and try and control weeds through cultivation and moving the soil many times. And I say try because that's what you'd be doing. It wouldn't be successful.
It's that's right. That's right. So, I mean, what I mentioned that petition there. What can we do as individual farmers to show people that it's safe? Do we need to be shouting more about this? Do we need to be engaging more?
As an industry, we need to be extremely proactive about it. Mm-hmm. And it's not simply a case of, it's okay, it won't get banned. We'd like to think it won't, and we're doing a lot of work, some of us are on Twitter, and making the public very aware of how good glyphosate is. And I do quite a bit with my local radio stations, Lynx FM and BBC Radio Lincolnshire. And whenever I'm on, which is quite regularly, I'm always constantly putting out messages to the public and to the housewife about farming and the good things we do. And this is something people can do. Local press, parish magazines, church magazines, county newspapers, anywhere anybody can put a good message about UK farming, we need to do this because, it's glyphosate is the issue at the minute, but, you know, when that gets relicensed, which hopefully it will, we need to keep going. There's lots of other issues we've got, like the neonicotinoids, you know, the oilseed rape and the seed dressings that are being banned at the moment. It's the alternatives are far worse and far more harmful. The alternatives that we're now using are far more harmful than the products that have been banned.
That's right. I mean, according to ADAS, the value of the use of glyphosate to the UK arable sector is £547 million. You know, that's serious money, isn't it? You know,
it's unreal, unreal. Yeah. How on earth they get to the figure, I don't know, but no. I would say that, you know, when you look at it, I know the value to my business.
Yeah.
And the percentage area we've got to, you know, in UK arable farming is absolutely minimal.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we'd manage. We would struggle greatly to control blackgrass. And I actually think probably a third of our farm we would actually end up grassing down because we wouldn't be able to grow crops on the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd grass them down. Just obviously bare soil isn't any good, so we'd grass it down. And then we'd probably, because of the rest of the farm wouldn't be a viable size, I'd have to let someone else in come and farm it, and then I'd have to go and get a job elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a very, very serious case. We need to write to MPs, need to write to MEPs, and don't let, you know, don't wait and expect your neighbour to do it or expect your friend to do it, because the more letters we get out there, the better it is. And invite people onto your farm. Invite other people, other farmers. Invite non-farming people. This is the thing we have to do. Invite these green parties to the farm. We need to just promote and get out the good stories of British agriculture.
That's right, because, you know, you log into Facebook and you see someone who might not, a friend of yours might not be farming, and they've shared some picture or something saying about glyphosate destroying the environment or something like that. And it's not their fault. They don't know, do they? Because they, you know, you hear the sort of big green organizations who've got big backers, you know, they're working hard to put their side of the story across, aren't they? And
definitely,
it's up to us, I think, to put our side across, isn't it? As much as we can.
Yeah, but I mean, the other way as well, obviously, with glyphosate is the other type of farming, is the no-till type of farming, which we've got a couple of fields in trial in that at the minute to see how we get on with it. And we've been in a couple of years doing that. And obviously, that sort of system is when you establish a different crop in the ground very early after harvest and to capture the nitrogen and build soil structure into the soil. And then you start off with glyphosate. And then direct drill straight into that dying cover crop with a specialist machine, So you're not disturbing any soil, you're not having any sort of loss in earthworm activity and killing those, which are a huge part in our soils now. We're all after protecting our soils and making our soils healthy. And it's these sort of things that we're trying to do now with the different farming methods and systems we've got. And glyphosate really, really enables the UK farmer to produce crops in an environmental way while caring for wildlife and caring for nature.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's glyphosate. We could talk about that all night, I'm sure. But I've got a big list of questions to get through, because you're involved in so many things. In 2008, you won the very prestigious Farmers Weekly Arable Farmer of the Year. As a very average farmer myself, and someone who'll never have that kind of experience, you know, how did that feel to be recognised by your peers like that? You must have been very proud.
It was an exceptionally proud moment, and one of those years that will live with me for a long while, because 2008 was the second time I'd hosted the Cereals event, which is the biggest outdoor farming show in Europe.
That's right.
And so that year I was hosting a huge show, and also I was shortlisted for the Arable Farmer of the Year award, which I had later found out in early October that I'd won. And it's amazing. If anybody has any doubts about these awards, about whether it's worthwhile to enter it, whatever you think and however much time you put into the application, it is definitely worthwhile entering all these competitions and these awards. Mm-hmm. Because even today, which we're looking at now 8 years, 9 years further on to when I won it, the farm today, I feel, is still benefiting from winning those awards, because everybody wants to be connected with you, machinery companies, chemical companies, and it is a very prestigious award, and it really puts your farm on the map. And I don't sort of regret one moment putting the entry in. No, it was absolutely staggering, and it's the award is very proud. It's sat on my office wall, and it's something that I walk past every day as I go in the office, and not once do I regret doing it.
No, absolutely. So you mentioned the Cereals event there, Andrew. You hosted it in 2004 and 2008.
I did, yes. Yeah. You know, hosting a very prestigious event like that, I was extremely proud to do that and welcome farmers from all over the country and actually all over Europe onto the farm. And being involved with something like that and helping organise it and set it up and run it was great, and I wouldn't have not done it for the world. And as a result of the 08 event, we had a contingent over from Poland who were looking to set up and run a similar type of event in Poland.
Oh, fantastic.
And so Haymark had asked me if I'd like to be involved in that. So I went over to Poland for 2 years and helped them find sites and set it up and run it, and basically, yes, had the show going in Poland near Poznan for two years.
Wow.
Until it was handed over to a Polish exhibition company.
Okay. Oh, that must have been fascinating.
It was. Yeah. And even then, you know, the Polish farm that the event was on, I've struck up great friends with the farm manager, and I'm still, even now, in contact with that chap now.
Mm.
And it's great. And I mean, you can imagine, on the 2 days of the show, Will, I was put on, I was volunteered as car park manager. And I was dealing with all the machinery setting up on the stand. So I was organising that and organising the forklifts and putting everything all the stands.
Yeah.
But then my levels of Polish are somewhat limited. And being told or asked if I would manage the car park, which of course I said, yeah, not a problem, man of my capability, I can soon do that, no problem.
Yeah.
And suddenly faced with this team of six Polish roughnecks, as you'd like to call them, because that's what they were, and talking to them and trying to understand and make them realise how we wanted the car park to run.
Yeah.
And it was just an enlightening experience, and one that will live with me forever.
Because I bet it was.
I've got this 30-acre field all lined out where cars to park, and the Polish farmers and visitors, all of them seemed to not want to use their feet, and they all wanted to park at the front of the car park. And I've got these six Polish guys and a couple of girls all stood with fluorescent jackets on, trying to direct Polish car drivers into their allocated parking slots in this field. And as cars ignored them, knocking them over as they were driving to the front of the car park, and all these Polish people just stood and looked at them and waved, and I couldn't get them to hold their arms out and understand what I wanted. So I had to get the farm manager to come and do an interpretation exercise and interpret my English into Polish. But that there was a problem, because I think he didn't even understand my English, because it needs to be translated from Lincolnshire. And so it was a very entertaining 2 days, I can tell you that.
I bet it was.
So...
yeah,
but great story. But no, it was great. The Sewers event here, you know, fantastic event. I won't be asked to host it again, I don't think, because I've got a great site only 15 minutes from me here, with a hard road and airfield all around the back of it. But, you know, great event, and again, something that will live with me, and I would not have not done for the world.
I'm sure. So one of the other big things you've been involved in, Andrew, and one of the other reasons I wanted to have you on tonight was Forage Aid. Now, why don't you tell us? Well, you had the idea. It's one thing having the idea, but it's another thing altogether to have the drive and enthusiasm to put that into motion. But why don't you tell us what it is and how it came about, please?
Yes, well, Forage Aid is something that I did start in 2013, and we're now a fully operational charity. And if you Google it or look at Forage Aid on Twitter or Facebook, we're on all of those platforms. Basically, it's something I started as a result of extreme weather in March 2013. And some people might remember there was some very, very serious snowfalls that was very late in the spring in two particular areas in the country, and that was Cumbria and Wales. And the snow was so deep, there were thousands and thousands of sheep were buried under 20 and 30 feet snowdrift.
That's right.
And we all saw news footage on TV, and it was just horrendous seeing people dig the sheep out of the snow.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed Gareth Wynne-Jones a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about it in length then. And, you know, the problems he had was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Exactly. You know, and Gareth now is a great friend of mine, and I always say, out of something bad always comes something good. And some of the situations that the families found themselves in, farming families, financially and emotionally, and the livestock situation was just horrendous. And it's great that everybody can get together, and more togetherness, I think, has happened because of some of these situations caused by the weather. But going back to how it started, when we saw all the footage on television and seeing how the farmers were suffering, I'd got a heap of haylage, some bales of haylage in the yard that we were selling. And I just thought that I walked past this heap one morning and I had a bit of a light bulb moment. And I thought, why? I'm selling that and probably getting £3,000 for this heap of haylage. And that's worth far more to somebody who hasn't got any feed to feed their sheep or cattle with. So through the NFU and one or two people up in Cumbria in those areas, I found three farms who were really, really desperately in need for it. I got Howsam Sprayers. We've mentioned them already, somebody we do a lot of work with in the area. Howsam Sprayers to take the load free of charge up to Cumbria. And that's how it started. And the first load went up there free of charge. Farmers Weekly, who I always do quite a lot with and get on very well with, did a bit of a story on it. Local radio did, and everybody liked that. And I just sort of said that I'd like, and if I can do it and donate a few bales, surely other people can. And gradually the job snowballed, and people ringing me up saying, I've got 10 bales here, 20 bales there, what do I do with it?
Yeah.
I just said, I'll leave me to do it, to sort it. Just contacted through all contacts and people we work with, hauliers. And we gradually got it moved and got various loads moved. And I think we got to about load 8 or 10. And the One Show, the BBC, picked up on what we were doing. And I was on the One Show for 20 minutes evening.
Yeah.
And that was just staggering, because the obviously that show is a very, very big programme. Mm-hmm. And we got then massively overnight the amount of people that were coming on board and offering us produce to move. And there's some great stories out of this, Will. And one of them was I had an old deer ring me up who'd seen me on the One Show, and I was requesting people would offer hay and straw and feed for the sheep. And this little old deer from an area in Birmingham said that she'd like to donate her lawn clippings. Could I come and pick it up?
How lovely is that?
And, you know, and it's just little stories like that. And there's so many people that were like that. And that, you know, and this old deer had to quietly say, well, thank you very much. But it's not quite going to be logistically possible to do that and the scale we're operating on. And I had to thank her. And I said, if you want to, if you feel you can get involved or would like to do anything, you know, I've said you can donate, you know, £5 or £10, whatever you think you can afford to the scheme. And so that's what she did in the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just stories like that. And
absolutely.
So that sort of went through into Cumbria, and gradually over the Cumbria job, we moved, I think it was about 70, 75 loads to Cumbria and Wales in that year. And it didn't finish. We didn't finish delivering till June. Another good story was that one farm up there, up in Cumbria, we were moving some loads up there, and the family had gone away for the weekend because the farmer was extremely stressed out. He'd lost his sheepdog down a great big ravine a few days earlier. So they went away for the weekend, and his neighbours looked after the sheep.
Yeah.
And we'd been trying to get hold of him to deliver a load of haylage. And so we delivered it into this yard, and the neighbours sort of sorted it for us and unloaded it. And this couple got back on the Sunday night from being away to try and relieve the pressure.
Yeah.
And the wife just saw this heap of produce that we delivered in the yard and just burst into tears.
Oh.
And rang me the next morning and she said, I just can't believe what you've done, and the gratitude we've got for you, we'll never ever be able to repay you. And I said, I don't want that.
No.
And she said, you won't know, she said, but we've been having marriage problems and marital difficulties because of the crisis that the weather has caused us, and she said, you might not realise this, but she said, potentially, not only have you saved our animals, you've probably saved my husband and my marriage as well. Jeez. And I thought, well, I'm known for lots of things, and to have that on my CV as marriage guide, where normally in Lincolnshire, I'm normally known for breaking marriages, not saving them.
I guess things like that must just make it all worthwhile, all the hard work worthwhile.
Well, it is. And then, of course, we got working in Somerset, and with the floods down in Somerset, we snowballed and got a huge number of loads moved in there. We've got great associations with JCB and Grow How Fertilisers, as they were, which is CF Fertilisers now. But the thing is, Will, there's so many farmers being supportive. And yes, I started it and sort of ran it, but we're now fully operational charities with 8 trustees. And without the support of the UK farmer and without the support of the haulage industry and lots of suppliers, it wouldn't be where it is today. And we work very closely now with RABI. We're operational in the Cumbria floods this last year, and the Prince's Countryside Fund support us, and the Farm Community Network do. And so we're very proud that we've got, you know, into bed, if you like to call it, with these other charities and work very closely with them, which is fantastic to think how many years these charities have been working.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, on behalf of everyone in agriculture, thank you, because, you know, without people such as yourselves helping in these times, then they'd be a hell of a lot worse, so...
Well, that's right. You know, it is, but it's the support of everybody. And the amount of things, even now, the recognition that Forage Aid is getting and the high esteem that Forage Aid as a charity is held is great. And the emotions that you see when I was in Cumbria with the floods recently, being in a farmyard with a 91-year-old farmer stood next to you in tears because he said the government don't help him, the environment agency don't help him. And he's never in once any of his 90-odd years in farming that he wanted any help. And yet there are farmers who were giving him straw and hay from particular loads his came from, was from East Anglia, who he'd never seen before. And yet without the help of their generosity and Forage Aid's organisation in getting it there, he wouldn't be able to tell the story and his animals wouldn't be alive to thank us. And just stood next to a 91-year-old farmer with tears streaming down his cheeks. Was quite an emotional, and I drove away from that farmyard with tears rolling down my cheeks as well, because it was just such an emotional experience.
Absolutely. And for that, you were actually awarded an MBE for services to Farm and Resilience by Prince Charles.
I was, and that's another huge accolade that I'm immensely proud of. But again, it's one of these things. I don't consider it to be a personal award. It's an industry award, because it's without the support of the industry and the ancillary trades, I wouldn't have got that award. No. But, you know, when I got the envelope and opened the envelope, and it had got all the crest on the front and things, was just an absolute jaw-dropping moment.
I'm sure.
And to go to the palace and have Prince Charles standing in front of you and having a chat with him was unbelievable, really, because he supports agriculture and he loves farming because he's a farmer himself.
That's right.
And it was a great experience to go to Buckingham Palace and receive the award. It really was.
Well, it must have been a hell of a proud day for you and your family.
It was very much so. Yeah. And to have that after your name is very pleasing, and I'm very proud. But you know, on the light-hearted side of it, you can imagine I've got a lot of these clowns and friends, if you like to call them that, who are saying, MBE, I wonder what that could stand for.
I can imagine.
And the amount of different different phrases and explanations I've got for the three letters MBE are mind-boggling, which we won't go into now.
I can well imagine. Well, but, and then, of course, on not such a happy note, famously, it was stolen.
I know. What a nightmare that was. August the 18th at 4:10 last year. My Discovery, Land Rover Discovery, was stolen, and in the glove box was my MBE. And people have said to me lots of times, "What on earth was that doing in your glove box?" Well, I'd been to
the first thing my wife said when I told her last night when I was researching you.
I can imagine she wasn't the first. She was about the 101st to say that. And I'd been to a function only a couple of days earlier, and people said, "Oh, would you bring your medal?" Not to wear it, but just to show it around the tables after the dinner. Show it around the tables, which I did. And so before the end of the evening, I whipped out into the vehicle and put it in the glove box and locked it up. Thought, right, next morning when I get back at night, I'll take it out and put it back in the house. And I forgot. And it was the day after that that the vehicle went missing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was without that. But then about six weeks ago, got another one through the post from Clarence House with a nice letter from Prince Charles's private secretary.
Okay, oh, so it's got a relatively happy ending then.
Happy ending, exactly. Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So. I mentioned I was Googling you last night. I told you I was creepy stalker act, and I was looking for dirt. But as I mentioned, you know, I couldn't find anything. All I could find was glowing praise and achievements. I tried Andrew Ward scandals, Andrew Ward strippers. I found nothing.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Except some very good websites that I might go back to at a later date.
I was going to say, wherever the authors of the website are, you want to have a word with them, because there's one story. When I won the Farming Hero Award at the Farmers Weekly Awards in 2013 after launching Forage Aid, and after the prize giving, I got escorted by Tom Bradshaw and a few other well-known farmers to one of the well-known clubs in London, and I think it was Stringfellows, and we got in this club, and of course, as soon as I walked in the door, I got this very, very tall foreign blonde lady came up and whisked me off into a private booth, but we sat outside first, and she said, "How much are you willing to pay?" I said, "How much am I going to get?" She said, "It'd be £400. And I said, "I'm very sorry." I said, "I've never paid for it in my life, and I'm not about to start now." And I said, "Actually, I've just won a very prestigious award at the Farmers Weekly Awards." And I said, "I don't think I should be paying you. I said, you should be paying me for the honour." and anyway, I managed to, she said, no, that won't happen. So I managed to get it down to £180 from 400. So I did the typical farmer discount bit, and I thought I did really well to get her down to less than 50%.
That's right.
But my wallet was empty, and then so she said, "There's a cash machine upstairs." So I went upstairs onto the street level to the cash machine, and then the opposite, this was about 4:30 in the morning, and there was a Subway sandwich bar on the street opposite, and my hunger got the better of me, so I shot across the road without cashing this money. And then in this sandwich bar was another young female. So I stood talking to her, and then we sat outside on the pavement for the next three quarters of an hour, passing the time of night till it started to get light. So that was it. And then about 2 hours later, I managed to get back to my hotel room, and 2 hours later, I got woken up by my mobile ringing at 7:45 in the morning with the voice, is that Andrew? And I said, yes. Oh, this is BBC Radio Lincolnshire here. We understand you've won an award. We'd like you live on air in 5 minutes. Is that okay? I was absolutely sort of well on the way, as you can imagine, 2 hours earlier. And I said, I'm really sorry. I said, I can't do it. I need to wake up. I said, I need to wake up. I can't do it yet. So they said, right, we'll call you back in 10 minutes. And the 10 minutes seems like about 30 seconds. Because no longer had I got my teeth brushed and got in the bathroom and splashed a bit of water on my face. The phone was ringing again. And they were counting me down to the time I was on. And they said, yes, we've now got Andrew Ward live on the radio from London, from a hotel in London. And hello, Andrew. And they said, did you have a good night? And I said, well, I did. But I said, I'm not quite sure. It's such a good night. I said, you've just got me out of bed. But I said, at the minute, I'm not quite sure the bed I've just got out of, whether it's my own or not. They very quickly went on to a track before they came back on. We think you need to wake up before we play you again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic.
So it was, so there's a few lighthearted moments like that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'll begin to wrap things up now because I've taken up a lot of your time. But, you know, you're obviously a man with his finger on the pulse. You know, your fingers in a lot of pies. You're obviously not the type of fella who gets in at night and falls asleep in the chair with his phone on silent when he's meant to be doing a podcast interview.
Funny you should say that, Will, because I am a little devil at falling asleep in the sofa. I can sleep. Everybody knows I can sleep absolutely anywhere. I have a few idiosyncrasies about me. One is I can sleep anywhere and literally wake up within seconds. Another is I only drink decaf. Not because it's healthy, because I like the flavour. And another one is I'm a Coke connoisseur and I only drink vodka and Diet Coke.
Yeah, okay.
And so I have a few funny things about me.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wrap it up now. I do a little feature every week. I call it 5 and 10. I'm going to ask you 5 quick questions if you could ask. Mm-hmm. Give me 5 quick answers.
Okay.
And we'll go from there. So if you're ready?
Yep, ready. Fire away.
If you weren't a farmer, what would you be?
A lifeguard on Bondi Beach.
Good answer. If you could only eat one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Steak.
Okay, and me too. What's the song that gets you up and dancing at a wedding?
I would say Take That and The Flood.
Ah, okay. Okay, wasn't expecting that one. Okay, good choice.
I've got quite a few songs like that, but that's one of my favourites.
Okay. If you were a ruler of your own country, what is the first law you'd introduce?
Politeness.
Yeah, that's a good one. Good one.
Politeness. It really annoys me when people are impolite and don't reply and things, just courteous and manners.
Yeah.
I would introduce an Andrew Ward manners law.
I think we've just got the title of the show there. Right, last and not least, who is your favourite fellow farmer on Twitter?
That is a bit unfair because I've got lots. I don't have one. I have many that I follow religiously, so I'm afraid I'm going to...
If there was one you would recommend to other people, who would it
be? I'm going to jib on that one. I will... There's lots on Twitter. Favourite ones, well, Gareth Wynne-Jones is a good one if you're looking at livestock.
Yep.
You've got Jake Freestone, Tom Bradshaw, Pip Partridge. There's a whole load of no-till farmers. Obviously, one very important person is yourself. you need following. You definitely. You put out an awful lot of rubbish. That's great.
I know. Well, you're right with the rubbish. I'm not sure.
No, we all do that, but yours is very interesting and enlightening.
Well, there you go. Well, thanks so much for taking the time, Andrew. I know you're an incredibly busy man, so I really do appreciate you coming on tonight.
No, pleasure, Will. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for asking me.
Keep up the good work with everything you do.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And for everyone listening at home, thanks for tuning in again and for the continued support. The podcast is now available on iTunes. Just search for Rock and Roll Farming. And I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.